This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowen. Many writers, probably most writers, struggle to get published, to get reviewed, to go on book tours, give talks, and get profiled in magazines and newspapers. Our guest, Karen Russell, hasn't had that problem. Her first novel, Swamplandia, wowed the critics, became a bestseller, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her new book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, is a collection of short stories, and they continue her exploration of strange and fantastical worlds and experiences. I was particularly moved by her story, The New Veterans, about a massage therapist, an Iraq War veteran, and his back of tattoos. Karen Russell grew up in Miami, lives in Philadelphia now. She was teaching at Bryn Mawr College and will be teaching creative writing at Rutgers University, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Karen Russell, we've been following you around, and we're happy to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Marty. I'm
happy to have you with us. And I began by talking about what a success you have been. Does it feel that way to you?
That's so funny. When you were saying that, I was thinking about how, you know, whatever movie interns I have made, you know, my version of that, it's all kind of struggle. I'm just like in stained sweatpants at the Starbucks trying to figure out what a novel is. You know, I mean, I think that I've been totally fortunate, but I also think that there were like long, dark years where, you know, of drafting.
But do you think, as you said, fortunate in that someone read you at the right time, that you just were saying the right things that people wanted to hear at a certain time?
I think the greatest lucky strike, the one that, you know, that felt sort of like a gift from the heavens, was that the New Yorker took a story when I was 23 for their debut fiction issue. And I'm not sure how the story would have unfolded had that not happened, because story collections are, you know, this notoriously hard sell. And, you know, at that point in time, I had maybe eight finished stories to my name, you know. I did Lamaze breathing when I got that call.
so you don't, and sort of weird to be asking these questions since I just met you, but you don't feel like a successful writer, or you don't want to feel like one?
Oh, I do feel like I do feel successful and fortunate, but I think it's funny because I guess I'm so acutely aware of the struggle that it was. Like, it was a difficult birth in sort of every case, you know. So it's tough for me to feel like it was all downhill skiing.
Do you have a certain approach to writing that you have sort of created for yourself? Are you an everyday kind of writer?
I've been lying about that on the road. I think
should
write every day. that sounds right.
It does sound right. And for you?
You should exercise and meditate.
Yes.
Every day. When I'm not kind of traveling or when I'm on my teaching days, I'm usually sort of so in the world of my students' stories. I write in the morning. It's changed a little bit. When I was in graduate school, and then you have like monomaniacal focus that's licensed by these amazing, you know, programs, then I would just write around the clock. You know, I would just go on these benders. I would get a growler of
a beer, right?
a coffee, and just go to town.
And were you one of those kids in, let's say, even in elementary school, where the teacher said, "Oh, you know, Karen Russell, she can write."
Yeah, I was lucky that way. I mean, I think I had like a chaste and passionate love for my English teacher, this woman, Miss Timmis, because I remember like laboring for hours. She would like write a smiley face if you could make her laugh. This was my exclusive goal in life for most of elementary school. I mean, it was like some kind of Shakespearean thing where I'd be like, I just want to bring pleasure to Miss Timmis, my English teacher.
Did you succeed in that?
I think, yeah. I mean, that was my earliest experience of a very direct experience of what it's like to communicate via writing to another mind, you know, and to feel seen and understood and have that connection. You know, it felt like a really genuine intimacy in this way.
And to make her laugh as well.
And to make her laugh as well, yeah. What kid doesn't crave that kind of affirmation? But that I was, couldn't catch a ball, you know, couldn't add. So thank God I had that one arena.
And does she know that she was the object of your pursuit?
Oh, probably. I mean, it was mutual, I would say. I mean, she would give me these adult books to read. None of them really kind of high literature, but like Tony Hillerman mysteries and Michael Crichton and things like this that, you know, were for adults. And that was a real pleasure. You know, you learn so much about the world that way when you're that age.
I love the title of this book, and it's the title of one of the stories in the book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. How important are titles for you?
I love titles, and I have this real perverse inclination to title things. I was going to say stupid, just to give them titles that I am embarrassed myself to say to other humans. That keeps happening.
Like, oh, is that right?
My first collection is called St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves.
Yes.
I cannot say that to strangers to this day without, like, getting so weird, like, apologizing or just rushing the end. So they're like, I'm sorry, St. Lucie, what? Is that a religious manual or what?
But it works for you?
Yeah, but then I sort of like, I mean, I obviously, right, because I, you know, I did it to myself.
Exactly, exactly, and, yeah. and kept it,
yeah, so I think there is, I do sort of like a weirder title, for sure.
Well, I notice even titles in some of your stories, we're talking vampires, we're talking wolves, we're talking Swamplandia, kind of a primordial world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a nice way to signal to readers, too, that, you know, Dorothy, we're not in Kansas anymore, kind of. I just think it's nice to kind of let people know that maybe it's not going to be a quiet tale of the Jersey suburbs or whatever.
And does that reflect your interest in fairy tales or science fiction? I'm just thinking of all the possible influences that go into stories like that.
Yeah, I definitely the fairy tales and fables. That's, I think, always sort of fed me as a reader and a writer. I think with something like Swamplandia, with that exclamation point, I was thinking just about the manufactured enthusiasm of Florida, too, you know, the really effortful enthusiasm. So there is this kind of commercial helium kind of pumped into everything down there.
And you grew up in Miami.
I grew up in Miami, yeah.
And I only visit Florida when I visit my father-in-law. But for me, it's strip malls, gigantic roads, yeah. Disneyland, or Disney World, I should say. The Everglades, of course.
Right.
Immigrants, old people. I mean, this talk about primordial mix.
Marty,
right?
You got it. That's the panorama. I mean, that was so expediently done. It is such a mix. It's a shame, I think, that Mickey is like our weird ambassador to the rest of the world. I don't know who elected that dude. Because it's so much more than that, right? But I think it's that those juxtapositions you just discussed where there's really primitive and astonishing and I really think sublime in every sense of the world, nature. So you have the swamps. You have these like liminal places that are, I mean, not pretty the way Yosemite is pretty, really kind of frighteningly beautiful with these, you know, Mesozoic lizards actually living there, you know. And then you also have this like strip mall hell.
Yeah. And lots of big roads.
Lots of big roads, right through the swamp. I mean, I do think there's something interesting about that fantasy is our big industry, but if you go to Orlando, it's a hell on this earth in some ways, right? Just there's this gorgeous nature all around it, but the theme park part, you know, where it's kind of more artificial worlds per square capita than anywhere else.
I'm always terrified when I read those stories about people who have released pythons and they get into the Everglades and now they're, you know, 25 feet long and roaming around Florida.
Yeah, the last time I was down there are all these wanted signs that say wanted giant African snails, I guess. Giant African snails that eat stucco are now, you know, proliferating down. Anything can grow there. That's the thing. It's sort of a like Chia Pet world, you know, the conditions are right for total sprawl and biblical plague. So
do you feel you're part of that, I guess, Carl Hyas and Dave Barry, who also live right about Florida and like you, their work is different, but sort of capturing the kind of surreal nature of either the politics or the entertainment, the culture.
Right. I do. You know, I'm reading Insane City now, which is so hilarious. But when I was a kid, that is what I thought a writer was. I would read like the Miami Herald columns of Carl and Dave, and I loved them. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought Dave Barry had the best job in the world because he was like a grown man who could write about boogers and I don't know, like stripper heels. And that was so exciting to me. I was thinking about this recently, that in any Florida novel, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think the stuff I'm doing is a little different. But nature, the ecology of Florida, always is a character, always plays a huge role. And I think part of it is that it can't just be backdrop in a Florida book. It's so immersive down there. If you walk outside, the weather actually envelops you, you know. There's humidity that draws the water out of your body, you know, or there's a hurricane that threatens everything. So that's interesting, right? Even in sort of like a totally humorous, whacked-out book like Insane City, the ocean plays this huge role.
Well, I'm thinking of Swamplandia, where you put this, I guess, a kind of an amusement park in the Everglades.
Yeah, which, you know, thank God, because of park services, couldn't happen. But there are a lot of places I mean, when I go to Florida, it's so funny because people will try to get me to cop to, you know, what is the real place this is based on? Because everybody down there has a memory of some roadside attraction, like Uncle Bebop, Swamp Buggy.
Yes.
You know, or like the, there's the Miccosukee Indian Village that is, you know, right there in the swamp.
And they're alligator in Swamplandia, I guess, alligator fighters, wrestlers.
Yeah, I like alligator fighters. The alligator wrestling was always a little bit anticlimactic to see when I was a kid. Because, you know, invariably it's just a gator who's sort of prone and then like a large sweaty man sitting on that gator. And they tape up the gator's jaws. So, I mean, there's some thrashing about, but it did seem sort of like an unequal contest.
So does Philadelphia, and this is where you've been living on and off for about the last year, does it seem kind of tame by comparison compared to Florida and Miami?
Oh, no, I think Philly's deeply weird. I mean, you know, I miss the ocean. I think that's a tough one. I figured out how to say the Schuylkill. This is a big milestone in my in my Philly tenancy, not to call it the Schuylkill anymore.
You have to learn to say the word beautiful.
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 Oh, I love that. I tried water ice. I'm on a roll here in Philly.
It feels weird enough to you?
Oh, well, I'm thinking now about, I just took my family to the Medical Oddities Museum, where my dad took his shoe off to show people his own bunions. He was like, "You think that's bad? Check this out." It was like competitive. You know, there's all kinds of pockets of strangeness here too, I think. I'm new enough that I'm still kind of discovering them.
But are you attracted to that? I mean, looking at your stories, and I had to sort of struggle to find the right words, because I think if you say strange, it can be off-putting.
Yeah.
But these are fantastical experiences or fantastical worlds that you've created seem to be interested in.
I hope so. But it's so funny. You know, I've been going on the road talking a lot now about the fantasy and reality.
Right.
Sometimes I feel like a little false even using those terms, because it makes it sound like I think they're discrete categories of things. You know, like you can really pinpoint what is fantastic and what's realistic on the continuum. And I just think most people, you know, we're always like projecting into the future or living in the past. I mean, everyone is kind of consumed with fantasies all the time. And like Florida, that was what I loved about it, was how seamless it would be. You'd go right from the parrot jungle to the Publix grocery store. And I'm sure that's possible in Philly too, you know. There's like the zoo balloon right next to some, you know, totally impoverished. I mean, it's all kind of rubbing shoulders, these really different worlds.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I actually want to have you read a section from your book, one of the stories in your book. The book is a collection of short stories written by our guest, Karen Russell. It's called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And as I said, her first novel, Swamplandia! Was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Karen Russell grew up in Florida, living now here in Philadelphia. She has been teaching writing, and will be teaching writing, actually, at Rutgers University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at drinkinginphilly.com.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
Musicians tell us they often feel pressure to conform to the latest trends, but for reggae soul singer Itana, success has come by staying true to her vision.
I'm not concerned about what category they put me in. I'm concerned that they get to hear it and understand it.
Itana tells us about her latest album, Better Tomorrow, next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Karen Russell. She's a writer and has written several books, two collections of short stories, a novel called Swamplandia. And as I said before, her most recent collection is titled Vampires in the Lemon Grove, and that's one of the stories in this book. I was really intrigued with this story that you wrote called The New Veterans, and I'm going to have you read a little section from it, but it's about a massage therapist, a woman named Beverly. It's about a soldier back from Iraq named Derek. And in a story like this, and I'm going to have you read a little section from it, was there something that got you started writing the story, like a little nugget, a little incident or germ that got you going?
I think the image of this tattoo was probably the starting point. Plus this woman at the Dedos Mágicos massage clinic, right? So the idea of a story that you could see that's visual and manipulable. The personal part of this story, I guess, in some ways it feels different. There was more at stake for me.
Your dad's a Vietnam vet.
My dad's a Vietnam vet, and a really close friend of our family was a sniper in Afghanistan. And a close friend of mine was part of the original Enduring Freedom is an ex-Marine. So I feel like, and then both of our grandfathers were veterans. So I just think it's kind of a more personal engagement for me in some ways.
And what's at stake here, I guess, or the focus is these two people and the fact that on Derek's back is this tattoo that just covers his back.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Ray Bradbury's The Illustrated Man, and then the Flannery O'Connor, her story, Parker's Back, which is also about this sort of fantastic whole back tattoo. And I think just as an image, you know, it's a really explicit way to think through storytelling and what it might mean. You know, first this impulse to get a tattoo, which is a permanent scar, right? Something that you're going to memorialize an event for your entire lifetime. I think that's the imperative when you go to get a tattoo. And in this case, Beverly, the massage therapist, is trying to get this guy to relax, to let go of old trauma and old pain, you know, in his body, and the tattoo starts to change on them. And so I guess I was also thinking about how unstable the past is at every juncture, that there's, on the one hand, this guy, Derek, wants to hold the day that his friend died forever. He feels like that's his obligation. And I think Beverly is really ambivalent about what real healing might mean for a character like this.
And the, of course, very intimate relationship between the
quite,
two of them.
It's quite intimate, right, and somatic. So
yeah. Well, let's have a reading then.
Okay. Beverly smiles down at him, rubbing the oil between her hands. She pulls at his trapezius muscles, which are dyed sky blue. His tattoo is the stuff of Dutch masters. Beverly is amazed that this level of detail is possible on a canvas of skin. Practically every pore on his back is covered. In the east, under his bony shoulder, there is an entire village of squat huts, their walls crackled white and black, with the granular precision of cigarette ash. South of the village, there's a grove of palm trees, short and fat. A telephone pole. Beverly grins, as proudly happy as a child to identify nouns. A river dips and rises through the valley of his lower back. Tiny cattle, with dolorous anatomies, are grazing and bathing in it, bent under black humps and scimitar horns. The sky is gas flame blue, and right in the center of his back, a little V of birds tapers to a point, creating the illusion of a retreating horizon. Several soldiers occupy the base of Zeiger's spine. What kind of ink did this tattoo artist use? What special needles? The artist dotted desert camouflage onto the men. Their uniforms are so infinitesimally petaled in duns and olives that they are, indeed, nearly invisible against Sergeant Zeiger's skin. Now that she's spotted them once, though, she can't stop seeing them. Their brown faces are the size of sunflower holes. Somewhere, a microscope must exist under which a tattoo like this would reveal ever finer details. Freckles, sweat beads, boot laces. Windows that open onto sleeping infants. The cow's tails swatting mosquitoes. Something about the rice grain scale of this world catches at Beverly's throat.
And that's Karen Russell reading from her book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, a story called The New Veterans. First of all, it's a beautiful passage,
Mary.
And a beautiful description of this man's back. As you wrote that, did you see every pore, every detail of his back?
I tried to. You know, I think a lot of writers are sort of jealous of visual artists, right? I mean, I think you're just using a different medium to paint, maybe. So, yeah, it would be amazing to be able to get a tattoo so precise.
Well, and do you have a tattoo?
No,
Have you ever thought of one?
I think in high school we just missed our chance at getting an E.E. Cummings tattoo, me and my pals, so thank God. Both my siblings do. I don't know how I missed. I missed the boat, maybe.
Would it be a poem by E.E. Cummings?
We were going to get a line, yeah, from the root, the root of the root of the bud of the bud of the tree called life, I think. But that was at age 15, you know. Even then ambivalent about commitment. So,
well, there's still time, just so you know. Right. But what's interesting about Beverly, the massage therapist, is she says she hasn't felt necessary for years. I mean, one gets a sense of her loneliness or aloneness. But here she is, she's a therapist. I mean, she's a massage therapist touching people's bodies.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking it's not a direct parallel at all, right? But the way that I saw these characters as sort of analogous is that Beverly desperately wants to give her life unreservedly to something good. And she says she's lost her faith that her two hands can change anything. She's working at this kind of shabby massage parlor, and she's, you know, was a caretaker for both of her parents and I think sort of missed her window to be a wife and a mother. And really, what's complicated about their relationship is it's not quite selfless, you know. She's very kind of aware that she's hooking into his trauma and that this healing relationship, she's become quite dependent on it, too. So I think I was just interested in sort of exploring those fault lines a little bit, kind of where two needs intersect like this.
I mean, I don't think gives too much away, but she's able to sort of massage away these pictures on his back.
Right. She really believes, and I hope it reads, there's a little ambivalence about what is actually happening.
Exactly.
Because she is so invested in being this miraculous healer for this kid. And she also has this, it'll sound like a delusion, but I think it's pretty common. She really wants to hold his worst memories for him. She wishes that she could remove the war from his skin and bone and just hold that for him. So that kind of fantasy of rescue. But the tattoo seems to be moving around, and as it's moving, his memories of this death day are indeed changing. And it seems like whatever's happening, she is, through this sort of the sessions of massage, encouraging him to forget.
And she sort of takes on some of these, what feels like some of these memories for herself.
Yeah, and I was really thinking about these wars that we've just lived through. There's a real social dimension to the haunting. And I was thinking about just from the civilian perspective, now we have a generation of new veterans, you know, of people returning from the war. But we all are going to bear these images. We're all trying to figure out how to tell the story and engage with our own culpability. So I sort of, although they're just two characters really in this story, I was thinking that it's a story that we're all part of, you know.
You write about the secret language transmitted by touch. I mean, the idea that she's massaging him and he's telling stories, there are no words there, but
right. So there's this really powerful kind of direct communion between these characters. I think where things get a little tricky are to listen to the story, how slippery it's becoming, and it's evolving into some new thing. And Beverly, I think, is, you know, healing can often feel like a betrayal, I think, to many people, because the scar heals. You can't see it anymore. It seems like you're moving on. You're leaving someone. So they're both quite ambivalent about that.
And she worries about hurting him and is surprised by some of the things where he does feel pain and where he doesn't feel pain when she thinks he might.
Right. I think this is, for me, one of the more personal parts of this story, but, a deep ambivalence about what would true healing be. Is there a way to tell the story that is, in fact, true, where you can really look at what you just lived through and bear the burden of that? It's not going to paralyze you. You're not going to get caught in guilt or traumatic repetition. And you can move forward, you know, because I think when you see anybody in pain, you know, the instinct is you just want to erase that pain. You just want to end it.
You're right. Memories are inoperable. They are fixed inside a person. They can't be smoothed or soothed with fingers. Don't be nutty, Beverly. She lectures herself in her mother's even voice. But if it turns out that she really can adjust them from without, reshuffle the deck of his past, leave a few cards out, sub in several from a sunnier suit. The idea that she can change his memories.
Yeah, I think it's so seductive to her to think that. And she herself is sort of this broken character, and so she has kind of a crippled, stunted personality in some ways, too, because she's been a caretaker for most of her young life. So I think, you know, it's about the limits of empathy in some way. I don't think that this woman really has any idea what this sergeant lived through abroad. But where she is able to empathize is just, my God, what if there is one trauma that you have to kind of keep cycling through forever? I mean, the tattoo really represents that for her, sort of carrying this story around forever.
Did your dad read this story? And did your friends who have served in wars, did they read this story?
Yeah, I did. Patrick, one of our friends, was kind enough to kind of fact check, you know, some of the lingo and stuff for me. My dad, I don't think, has read it. I know he's very proud, but it's hard. You know, I don't think that he's read this one.
But is it in certain ways not an homage to him, but obviously he has had memories. I don't know how much he talked about his war.
I mean, and I suppose for me, it's more kind of for my friend who did serve in Iraq. I mean, that was sort of my, with these two wars, he was my closest contact, a returning veteran. But in my dad's case, you know, I say in here, there's one day that has this gangrenous spread and kind of overwhelms the life of a body. And that is something I feel pretty familiar with, because I would say that my dad, maybe that was, you know, he was there in 68. He was in, you know, it's like 3 years of his life. And yet, if you think about the psychic toll and the shadow it casts and how much I, you know, to the exclusion of any other memory I've heard about that period, it's impressive. You know, that's the wrong word. I mean, it's monstrous, I think.
Did he talk about it? Has he talked about it?
Mm-hmm.
He did.
Yeah.
Which is probably, we've done shows about this where people come back for more and they never say a word.
And they never say a
word.
And
their children and grandchildren are just sort of left scratching their heads.
Well, that's the thing. I think that language might not be the best tool to really, I mean, it's funny. I mean, he'll talk about it, but in a very elliptical way where, you know, that like, it's just sort of, you're just orbiting something that can't be said. And my grandfather, it wasn't until he was very close to death, he never spoke about World War II. And then it was like a glacier thawing or something. And then he really wanted to talk about it. So it's funny to imagine. For me, it's like these stories, they do have like kind of a physical existence inside your body. And I think that idea of like a glacier that starts to melt in stream, you know, with this tattoo that appears to be sort of doing exactly that on this guy's back, it's something, right? That the past is just the story that we tell about it, really.
Indeed. Let me just reintroduce you. That's Karen Russell, our guest today on Radio Time. She has a collection of short stories titled in a book called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. She's also the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called Swamplandia, and I should say it was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Gabriella from Trenton to join us. And Gabriella, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Karen. I am so intrigued by your story. I'm also from Miami, and I'm also living on the outskirts of Philly right now. I'm a college student. I'm an English major, and I was so intrigued by I was actually surprised to hear you say that you were, like, embarrassed to talk about, like, the titles of your work and whatnot, and I just, like, see that so much in myself. But from writer to writer, I feel so inadequate in my writing to the point where I don't even want to show anyone my writing. And I mean, my writing probably isn't inadequate at all, but I just feel so self-conscious about it. So from writer to writer, how do you get over that hill?
And Gabriella, you are not alone, but go ahead,
no,
Karen.
No, you're definitely not alone. And how nice to meet another Florida girl up here in the chilly north. I wonder if you set your stuff in South Florida too. But for the self-consciousness, I think if you're in a class, that can be one way to get over it. You're forced to turn stuff in, you know, and then your peers read it and kind of make it real by that Pinocchio magic. I think it's good to send stuff out, you know, send out to contests. That's something I used to do just to kind of have it real, you know, where you think that another, you know, that another reader's mind is going to apprehend it. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what, and Gabriella, thanks for the call to Radio Times, but having interviewed so many novelists over the years, you know, I wonder whether anyone ever thinks that what they've written is good enough. Are they really, you know.
If you're just high-fiving yourself at the computer, likely it's terrible. I mean, I don't know that many monstrous, you know, monster ego writers that are, you know, I do know some people that will be casting the movie of their book, you know, as they're writing, and that's never where you want to live. I also think for myself, the stuff that's often the most powerful material, Gabriella, is what feels most exposing, most embarrassing. Mm-hmm. So that might not even be, that might be a great sign, actually, if you're feeling a little exposed.
Good luck, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me quote Stephen O'Connor, who I know was an MFA professor for yours, and I stumbled across this advice, I guess, that he gave to you and other of his students, that good writing should be surprising and true.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
I love a cameo from Stephen O'Connor.
But I love what he says.
Isn't that a wonderfully, just a really economical way to get at it? And I think he said that on my very first day of graduate school. It always stayed with me because, first it's, you know, it's deceptively difficult
True, for instance.
To be true. And I think writers are always, even if they're writing the most whacked out stuff, trying to invent a way to be true, to be honest. And surprising, you know? That I think that's one of my favorite experiences as a reader is when you read a line, oh my God, it's something you know to be true deeply in your bones, but you have never articulated it that way. You've never seen it articulated. You know, or sort of laughter, I think, does that often. What you're laughing at, it's like the shock of recognition, you know? It's something so absurd. You knew this all along, and now it's been brought to your conscious attention.
Well, that's the reader's experience, but I'm thinking about the writer's experience, the kind of surprise that you might feel as a writer.
Oh, that's, well, and when Gabriella was saying about feeling exposed, I think often my, you know, it's just disorienting, but Flannery O'Connor has that great story about when she's writing the, you know, she didn't know a wooden leg would be stolen in her story until that paragraph where it happened. Right. And that's always exciting. If you kind of have a conscious idea about where you're moving and something out of left field appears on the page, or if you're, I often, for me, it's something I'm resisting writing about and I keep orbiting back to it.
And do you have a barometer for what's true for you? Or, I mean, does such a thing exist?
Yeah, well, I guess it's evolving, right? But I do think I have some intuitions about what feels true. I definitely know when I'm kind of embroidering, you know, or kind of just like spinning the ball, you know, and not engaging with something scary or complex.
If you're resisting it.
Yeah, that can be one sign, I think. If I'm embarrassed sometimes too.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers as well. And again, Karen Russell is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her growing up in Miami and the fact that she lives here in Philadelphia and her writing. Her book, Swamplandia, written a couple of years ago. Her first collection of short stories, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, and her new collection of short stories is Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Questions or comments, give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Academy of Vocal Arts, presents Don Quixote, March 2nd through 9th in AVA's Helen Corning Warden Theater, and March 12th and 14th at Centennial Hall in Haverford. Jules Massenet's opera is a lyrical ode to the chivalrous idealist Don Quixote. Christopher Makatsouris conducts the AVA Opera Orchestra with staging by Tito Capobianco. 215-735-1685 or avaopera.org.
Nobody expected Mike Piazza to make it in the big leagues, but he became a 12-time All-Star. On the next Fresh Air, Piazza talks about his life in the game, being inaccurately outed as gay, and getting a clubhouse call from Roger Clemens after the pitcher beamed him.
I was not in the mood to talk, so I basically told him where to put the phone.
Join us
today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The U.S. Department of Education tweaks its qualification standards and unexpectedly cuts off some loans to thousands of students at historically black colleges. Also, treating and preventing PTSD by studying the warrior brains of Navy SEALs. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, having a very intense conversation with Karen Russell during that break. Our guest today on Radio Times, she is a writer. She lives here in Philadelphia now. She grew up in Miami. She was doing some teaching at at Bryn Mawr College, and she'll be teaching at Rutgers University, teaching creative writing as well. We've been talking about some of her writing, and she read a section from one of the stories in her new collection of short stories. She read a section called from a story called The New Veterans, and the book is called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And we've been taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You have a story in this. It's titled The Barn at the End of Our Term. And it's, I don't even know how to weave all this stuff together, but let's start with Rutherford B. Hayes, right? A former president. I asked you this for your other story. What was the little nugget that got this story going?
You know, this is a funny one because it's one of the older stories in this collection. And when I do the reconstruction, I'm like, I guess, what do I say? NyQuil? Like, was it just NyQuil? Like flu medication that got this started? I was, you know, I had read a book that I really recommend to everyone in love called A Brief History of the Dead by Kevin Brockmeyer. And part of it deals with sort of this antechamber between life and death. So I think I had a couple... Some questions. What I loved about this book is that nothing was resolved. Nothing was less mysterious after people died. In fact, they were still scratching their heads trying to figure out what the hell was going on. So I sort of, just seemed interesting to me. Like, it did seem like sort of a naive faith. Why do we think death will be the final answer? What if it's even more confusing afterwards? And then I had seen this documentary about the U.S. presidents. That was just full of these kind of pompous voiceovers, you know, where they show this is like kind of a very Philly thing, too.
I've seen those. Yes.
Yeah, show like the scroll and there's like a quill pen and someone's really anxious about their legacy. And a couple, you know, some of the presidents were really upset about leaving office. It was such a difficult thing to leave that power. And I was thinking, that's everybody, no one's excited, you know, to leave office. It seems scary and difficult. So just that maybe as a parallel to death. And I guess my original impulse was that I was going to have all of these presidents who were so concerned about their legacy reborn into humiliating circumstances. And the first one I wrote was Rutherford B. Hayes is reborn in the body of a horse, this pinto horse. And I just had so much fun doing that. I liked that so much. I was like, oh, my God, they're all going to be reborn as horses. And instead of the Hall of Presidents, it's this weird Kentucky stable in some kind of afterlife.
It's great. It's great. But I also think it helps us, takes us a little bit into your brain and how, you know, how you're borrowing things, you're seeing videos, and then that turns into something about Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yeah.
Is that how your brain works?
And I'm never even really sure, you know, to be honest, when people ask for the origin story, I'm like, I don't know, maybe that's the best reconstruction, you know, kind of. Mm-hmm. Murder mystery dramatic recreation I can do.
but you, I mean, and it's, I should say to our listeners, when you came in and I met you and you sat down, you just, you said, you know, I have a sort of distractible nature, and I I appreciated you telling me that, but I also wonder whether that's part of where some of your stories come from.
I think so, right? I do. I have like a really kind of hopscotchy sort of brain, like very associative. It makes it often difficult, you know, because I can't, you know, there's the direct route, there's the Ahmed's razor route, and then there's whatever crazy way I take, which is like...
The circuitous route,
just
right?
Circuitous, yeah. I sort of feel like it is the way. I just came back from Aspen, and they were trying to teach me to ski. You know, I'm from Miami. And I'm like, I write the way I ski. Like, I'll get to the bottom of the mountain, but it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to make sense what I did to get down there.
But do you think that's helped make you a writer? That's the way your brain works.
I think I sort of love these other writers who are kind of genre mashup people or master synthesizers. You know, they're fed by a lot of sources. You know, Calvino or Kelly Link or Borges, or, you know, so they're sort of like Western sci-fi, sort of like philosophy. It's all kind of mixed in there to make something new. And it's nice, you know, to feel like there's some role models out there who are capable of kind of darting around like magpies and then making some hybrid out of all that material.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we have Ephraim from St. Louis joining us on Radio Times. Ephraim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I'm a veteran in the Air Force, and I'm actually still in the National Guard and preparing to go back overseas again.
Wow.
And as the young lady was sharing her her descriptions of the massage therapy and the tattoo and everything, that just struck a chord. I was just totally impressed, and I heard about the book through a friend as I've been processing in my brain the reality of heading back over there in harm's way, and it just really struck a chord for me, and I'm a huge fan, so I just wanted to say great job, keep up good work, and I'm also from Florida, so you made us all very proud. Good job.
Oh, thank you so much for your service, Ephraim. Thank you so much. Be safe over there, okay?
Indeed. Yeah, Ephraim, thanks. Can I ask you, Ephraim, do you have a tattoo?
I do not. my mother told me as a kid that that the body I have is not mine, that God's going to hold me accountable to it, so I was too chicken.
Yeah. So you don't want to deface it.
Right. Well, very gravity is coming, right? We're getting older, Ephraim, every day, so that's probably wise.
Right.
Gravity is kind of cruel to tattoos, mm-hmm. but Ephraim, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Thank you for doing what you all do, both of you. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks so much. How do you think about your readers? I mean, it's such an interesting relationship, don't you think? I mean, these are people you don't know, or maybe contact you through the internet.
It's totally radio interesting. And I feel like amazed and really grateful. I think that if the story works at all, it's like almost entirely because of the reader in some ways. You know, they're supplying everything. It's like you just wrote some score for the player piano. So I think, and it's mysterious, right? I think about that all the time. Whatever raw materials other people are using to assemble these stories, that's their own history. It's whatever brother meant for them or mother meant for them. You know, it's whatever Florida looked like when they went there, like those images. So,
do you like books? Do you like, you know, e-books, those kinds of things?
No, I really
love
books.
You like to hold something?
I understand the appeal of ebooks. I was just hefting around that Chris Ware. My brother got it for me for Christmas. I was like, this is a passive-aggressive gift. I've got to go through 3 airports to get home, dude. You know, that giant box. But at the same time, how great to have this physical object, you know.
Ephraim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I was doing a little bit of reading about you, and it sounds like you come from a superstitious family, or a family that does superstitious things.
Yes. My mom is not. My mom is like the yin to our yang. You know, she's very like, that's ridiculous. So thank goodness there's some kind of like stabilizing force. But my dad is a crazy superstitious person, and I think all of us are in different ways. My brother needs to like kind of fist bump me, and everyone's like, oh, that's so sweet. I'm like, no, he becomes very anxious if I don't do that. It's
how often a fist bump?
I'm not sure what triggers it. We should call my brother, but everyone will be like, how sweet. I'm like, no, you misunderstand. Right. this is like exactly like knocking on the table or throwing salt over your shoulder.
Is that what you do?
I do both of those, yeah. Isn't that, discreetly sometimes. It's just the old stuff, right? We don't even know what the origin is, but, like, don't walk under a ladder. Bad things come in threes.
So the number three has, and it's interesting you said that, because as a kid growing up, the number three also was a bit fraught for me.
I wonder what is going on with the number three. I was reading the Grimm's fairy tales, the new anthology. There's some numbers. Who can even explain it? Maybe neuroscience will explain it, but we have a peculiar relationship. Like, why three and not four?
Yeah, exactly.
But everybody knows it's got to be three, you know? Nobody gives no one gives a crap about the number four. They're like 3, 7, you know, the primes.
The primes are the odd ones. As you said, you knock and do little things. Have you done that kind of surreptitiously during the hour?
I'm actually just knocking under this table this entire interview. I've just
have you
been blessing myself? No. It's relaxed a little bit. It was worse when it was more acute when I was a kid. Yeah. I think, and I do sort of think that can kind of be a hothouse bloom. This weird childhood OCD. Or whatever that is, if you feel so powerless when you're that age, right? You have kind of zero agency, but it's not like you're not aware of the million threats out there. So I think it's a way to feel powerful a little bit, you know?
And also to do it in a disguise kind of way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sort of trickiness that's involved in that.
So
as well.
It's really covert. So, yeah, it's funny. It's a private world of childhood. I mean, yeah, I was talking to someone who said she used to have to throw quarters in like a fountain. Like, where you even invent that stuff, you know, and why it will kind of bloom and then fall away again. Who knows?
Do you have certain childhood stories that have stayed with you or influenced you or just enthralled you?
From my childhood or from literature?
From your childhood.
Oh, gosh. I'm sure definitely, right? I mean, you know, one of the narratives, I guess, of our family is Hurricane Andrew. That was kind of a big before and after because that destroyed our house.
Did it really?
It really
literally?
Did. It really literally did.
Flattened it?
We rebuilt it, but it, yeah, and you know, all the pictures were lost, and this was, like, before the internet age. So that was, like, that was our, yeah, wow, kind of like our biblical hinge as a family.
Lost everything? I mean, the thought of losing pictures.
I don't know. That was the heartbreak, you know? Mm-hmm. We lost a lot, you know, in the bottom. The sea came in and sort of we were close enough to the ocean that, like, just, you know, that was a surreal kind of Dr. Seussical time in Florida when people were finding sharks on their roofs or, you know, their boat was, like, on top of the Burger King, you know, whatever.
How old were you?
I was in sixth grade. So
old enough to remember and to see all that.
We came up here. We came to Pennsylvania. We stayed with our Pennsylvania cousins for a time. So I guess that's not really a story, except that the part that, you know, I was a kid, so I didn't really understand consequence. So one of my – happy is the wrong word, but one of my the memories that is most vivid in, you know, in my life really was the night of the hurricane, because our whole family got into this bathroom. We were all, like, sitting in the tub. I loved it, right? Because I loved it. And you could see out the window, like, these palm trees were sweeping the ground with their fronds. There was, like, green lightning, like this crazy electric-looking lightning. You know, the world was totally transformed. And because I was too stupid to be scared, you know, didn't know enough to be scared, I just remember it was like this insane ballet where giant poinsettia tree sweeping the ground with its crown. You know, it was, I feel lucky in a way that I saw it at that age, because I would have been terrified a little later. And I could just see that it was so beautiful.
It probably helped to have your family around, too.
Can you imagine when you're a kid, you're like, there's no school. I get to chill in a bathtub with my grandfather in this dry tub. It's so fun. We're eating snacks, you know.
Did you try poetry at all? And I ask that only because of just the language that you use. It seems that it would work very nicely in a poem.
Yeah, I wrote terrible poems. I was such an ostentatious kid. You know, when you're like sort of, you're like, you're like theatricalizing whatever kid thing you're doing. You're like, don't mind me, I'm writing a poem. So I would like just go. I would sit on this grassy strip in the median of our street with this like yellow legal pad and write these long, long, like rhyming poems about like my island. I guess my island being this like crappy circle of like dead grass in the middle of the road.
Vivid
so,
imagination.
Yeah, I loved poetry. And
do you write it now? Do you feel tempted or ready?
I think a lot of fiction writers are would-be poets. I think we failed at poems. The poems just got really long. Got too long and, you know, just continued horizontally instead of
vertically.
Yeah. I tried to write poetry in college, and it was good training for a fiction writer because you really have to pay attention to the way language is micropulsing on the line. And the power of just two words rubbing together. I mean, you have to really slow down and pay attention.
This seems like animals are part of your imagination.
Yeah, they keep
cropping up. Did you grow up with animals? And did you have pets and things like that?
Oh, my God. We did have pets. We would have all these, like, doom. You know, what? There should be a specific word. I'm sure the Germans have one. For, like, the guilt of a child wishing its pet would run away or perhaps die. Because we would, like, bring in all these weird crabs and stuff, you know, from the ocean. And then they would, like, live for a Methuselah age. I'd be like, wow, it's 1996 and that crab is still alive. So, you know, or we had, like, lizards. I think that I developed self-consciousness when I was a really little kid because there was, like, a lizard just in the shower. So I was like, wow, I'm embarrassed. I guess I'm a self, you know. So in Miami, like we were saying, the immersive nature, there's just, you can't.
I was thinking of cats and dogs, and you're talking lizards and crabs.
Well, so. we had these like cross-eyed schnauzers too, but they sweet inbred dogs.
One thing I also noticed, and I haven't read all your stories, but there seems to be a theme of metamorphosis or transformation. And I'm thinking about the Rutherford B. Hayes ending up as a horse, but it seems like that's also a theme that you. That are in some of your other stories as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think also, you know, I mean, Kafka was a huge influence. So there you go, right?
There you go. But metamorphosis,
yes. And just thinking about the separation of sort of your chatty mind and then like Dee's older animal, you know, just the illusion, you know, that your mind is really running the show. I think I feel that myself, you know. Mm-hmm. And just speaking of animals, right, I think this idea that you're like a part of nature and a part of this, there's like this real like kind of inhuman autonomy, you know, happening around you. So the metamorphosis tales, I mean, I guess in this collection there are a lot of kind of monstrous metamorphoses. Yeah. These girls are transformed into these silkworms. In my earlier work, I had kind of werewolf children who are forced to wear shoes and they're civilized by nuns. You know, I have a minotaur father, and I like the divisions. They never feel that stark in life, right? You're never like, here's the serrated line where I become an animal. But it is sort of maybe an exaggerated way to think about the collision of sort of your conscious self, your calculating, reasoning self, and this this unconscious stuff, or this sort of older impulses. I don't know.
Well, Karen Russell, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. That was really fun.
Fun for us as well. And Karen Russell, our guest, and her collection of short stories is titled Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Her previous collection of short stories is St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And her novel Swamplandia, published a couple of years ago, a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Katie Ricciardi, our intern today. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.